Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Navigating the Complexities of Stroke by Lewis R. Kaplan, M.D., F.A.A.N. Narrated by Graham Rowett. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to tables and figures present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Foreword. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. Strokes are awful. There's no getting around that fact. If you, like me, have had a stroke, you will agree. If you have a loved one who has had a stroke, you will also agree. I am telling you this not because I want to depress you, but because I want to be brutally honest. When I was 26, I lost speech, vision, the ability to walk, and the use of my hand. I got better, but it took many years. My stroke has shaken my family and friends. Recovery has been the biggest challenge of my life. For stroke victims and their families, recovery is possible, but it can be very slow, and the pace can be disheartening. So you have to become more patient than you were before. In my case, I had to do those blasted exercises again and again for hours a day, while all my friends were off in society becoming doctors and tycoons, getting married and having kids. The only way I was able to tolerate the trial of this stroke was that I had a really encouraging network of friends and family. When I encountered people who were not kind or encouraging, I departed. When a physical therapist told me, unasked, that I might never get rid of an ankle brace, I switched therapists. I also got rid of my ankle brace. I encourage patients to shop around if you are not satisfied with your care. Neuro rehab is very different from one city or hospital to another. I found it helpful to compare my progress to the month before. Can my arm reach higher than this time last month? Do my words come out from the cobwebs of my mind more quickly? Am I still rude to waiters? For a while after my stroke, I lost my manners. Now I am a pleasant dinner companion again. Reading about your stroke can be very helpful. I found that learning about it from a height as a detached student makes it more manageable. I'm also a patient of Dr. Kaplan's. Navigating the Complexities of Stroke is designed to provide you with detailed guidance about the brain, the different kinds of strokes, their treatment, and the aftermath for patients and their caregivers. Having this information in one place can be very useful as you navigate rehabilitation and the medical bureaucracy. Anyone who is at risk of stroke, those who care for stroke patients, and patients themselves can all gain wisdom from this book. When I see Dr. Kaplan, he usually tells me to get on with my life. In that vein, I encourage you not to think about your stroke all the time. This is hard because so much of your brain and body is broken. Try to have adventures and fun. Surround yourself with people who love you, even if you are less nimble than before. Nina Mitchell, Boston, Massachusetts. Nina's stroke website is mindpop.net. Preface. This is the second edition of a monograph commissioned by the American Academy of Neurology that aims to inform the public about stroke. Recognizing that listeners will have diverse educational backgrounds and medical experience, I've tried to make the book useful for all levels of listeners. Stroke is complex. The organ involved, the brain, is the most diverse and complex of all the body's structures. I've tried in this book to capture that complexity and still render enough easily digested information to make it useful for all listeners. As in the first edition, I use individual patients to illustrate different types of stroke. After introducing 4 patients, I add information about their symptoms, evaluation, and treatment in the chapters devoted to those topics. I then summarize their cases at the end of the book. Individual cases help audiences understand the general principles discussed. I believe this edition represents a major upgrade from the previous publication. I've added a chapter on strokes in babies, children, and young adults. I've added new information and illustrations, which can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book, in each of the other chapters. I have completely reordered the chapters. The brain and its functions and blood supply are now placed first, after the introduction. One of the major reasons that the public in general is less knowledgeable about stroke compared to cancer and heart disease is the complexity of the brain and the diversity of symptoms. By discussing the brain and its anatomy and functions first, I aim to clarify why certain symptoms occur and what they mean. Publication of printed materials has also changed dramatically since the first edition in 2006. Oxford University Press, one of the world leaders in medical publications for doctors and the public, will make this material widely available as an ebook and for iPads and other devices. I hope in some small way the information in this book helps listeners prevent strokes and arms them and their families to navigate the complexities of their medical care and recovery. Lewis R. Kaplan, M.D., Boston, Massachusetts, Fall 2012. Chapter 1. Introduction. Why is stroke so important? It was then that it happened. To my shock and incredulity, I could not speak. That is, I could utter nothing intelligible. All that would come from my lips was the sound ab, which I repeated again and again. Then, as I watched it, the telephone handpiece slid slowly from my grasp, and I, in turn, slid slowly from my chair and landed on the floor behind the desk. At 5:15 in that January dusk, I had been a person. Now at 6:45, I was a case. But I found it easy to accept my altered condition. I felt like a case. Eric Hodgins. Hodgins E. Episode. Report on the accident inside my skull. New York. Athenaeum. 1964. Pages 7 to 14. Effect of strokes on individuals. When speakers and writers stress the importance of stroke, they usually quote numbers and statistics. But to me, the most important aspect of stroke is its effect on the individual person who develops a stroke. What is more frightening and devastating than to suddenly become unable to speak, understand speech, move an arm or leg, stand, walk, balance, hear, see, read, feel, write, or remember? Loss of function is often instantaneous and totally unanticipated. The first common term for stroke, apoplexy, literally meant struck suddenly with violence, in Greek. The word stroke refers to being suddenly stricken. Losing brain function can be dehumanizing and often makes individuals dependent on others for ordinary daily activities. The brain is without question the most important organ in the human body. It is responsible for our movements, feelings, moods, thoughts, and perceptions, and it enables our unique personal characteristics, our abilities and failings, our intelligence, our feelings, and our personalities. Our brains make us what we are. The loss of any brain function diminishes the person in us. In surveys that ask individuals about their worst health fears, most people rate cancer and stroke at the top of their lists. People worry about the pain of cancer and fear losing their mental and physical functions and becoming dependent on others if they were to have a stroke. Everyone would like to exit this life with their capabilities and mind intact, despite the inevitable aging of their bodies. The quote at the beginning of this chapter was written by a famous writer, Eric Hodgins, the author of a once very popular bestseller, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. In Hodgins' later book, episode, report on the accident inside my skull, he describes exactly what it felt like to be suddenly deprived of speech and movement of his right limbs. He changed from a highly functioning human being in one moment to a helpless, dumb invalid, a case, in the next instant. Imagine an articulate author dependent for his livelihood on his use of language becoming totally unable to speak or write. The complexity of stroke. Stroke is a complicated condition. Strokes have many different causes and have very different effects on individuals. Loss of function may be temporary or permanent, slight or devastating. Some functions may improve, while others remain impaired. It will prove easier for listeners to understand explanations about stroke if they are able to follow individuals who have had strokes. For that reason, I now introduce 4 stroke patients. I will refer throughout the book to these individuals, their symptoms, stroke risk factors, the causes of their strokes, their evaluations and treatments, and the effects that their strokes had on themselves and their families and environment. Robert H., a 68-year-old retired engineer, lived with his wife. His 3 children were married and no longer lived at home. He had had many health problems during the past. His blood pressure was discovered to be high 20 years ago. He'd been given a number of different pills, but high blood pressure remained a problem that was not always well controlled. 10 years ago, he had a heart attack and had to have surgery on his coronary arteries. For the past few years, he has felt pain in the right calf of his leg when he walks. His doctors told him that an artery to that leg had narrowed. Similar blood pressure and heart problems had led to his father dying at age 51. His brother also had hypertension and had had several heart attacks. One sister had had a stroke. One day at work, Robert noticed that his left hand and arm felt numb and that he could not hold objects in that hand. The weakness and numbness lasted about 15 minutes. He assumed that he had leaned on that hand. 2 days later, shortly after he awakened in the morning, his left face and hand felt numb and tingly for about 5 minutes. That afternoon, a shade seemed to come over his right eye, and he could not see from that eye for about a minute. These symptoms worried him, and he scheduled appointments with his eye doctor and primary physician. 2 days later, before he saw either doctor, when he tried to get out of bed in the morning, he fell on the floor. His wife heard the fall and rushed to him. She recognized that his left limbs could not move, but Robert seemed unaware of the nature of the problem. She called an ambulance and rushed him to the emergency room of the hospital. Claire H., a 29-year-old lawyer, began to notice intermittent pain in her left face and neck. The pain was often sharp and was sometimes accompanied by headache. She lived at home with her husband and 2 small children. She was very athletic and played ice hockey on a team several nights a week. Her health had been excellent. She took no medications, and a recent checkup showed no health problems. One of her uncles has had lung cancer, but there was no history of heart disease or stroke in her parents, their siblings, or her own 3 brothers, all of whom were older than her. 3 days after the onset of the neck and face pain, Claire began to hear a pulsing sound in her left ear. Later that day, her right hand and arm went weak, and she could not speak well. Her husband collected her at work and drove her to the hospital. Tom M., a 61-year-old single man, became ill at work. He was a longshoreman who did heavy physical work. While straining to lift some heavy cargo, he felt dizzy and lurched to his left. He staggered and seemed drunk to his co-workers. Several minutes later, he vomited and reported that he had developed a bad headache in the back of his head and pain in his left neck and shoulder. In the past, he had been healthy, but he admitted to drinking wine rather heavily. He did not visit doctors regularly. When checked by the company doctor 4 years previously, Tom was told that his blood pressure was a bit high and would need to be rechecked, but he had not followed through. Elaine S. was an 82-year-old woman. Her health had always been good. She was a widow who lived a very active life and often babysat for her grandchildren. Recently, she noticed episodes in which her heart beat fast and irregularly. This would last from 2 to 15 minutes and worried her, but she did not tell her doctor. One afternoon, her left hand and leg suddenly went weak, and she felt tingling over the entire left side of her body, including her face. She immediately went to the hospital. I will have much more to say about these individuals in the various chapters in this book. In chapter 16, I will summarize their cases. Numbers. Stroke is, and has been, the third leading cause of death in most countries for a very long time. Only heart disease and cancer are bigger killers. Strokes are a more important cause of prolonged disability than any other medical condition. Survivors of strokes are often unable to return to work or to assume their former effectiveness as spouses, parents, friends, and active participants in their communities. In the United States, nearly 800,000 individuals have a stroke, and 150,000, 90,000 women and 60,000 men, die from stroke each year. 3/4 of the strokes each year are first strokes, and 1/4 are recurrent strokes. Heart Disease and Stroke Statistics, 2010 Update, a report from the American Heart Association. Circulation, 2010, 121, page E46 through page E215. At any one time, there are about 2 million stroke survivors living in the United States. In China, approximately 2.5 million people have a stroke each year, and 1.5 million people die each year because of stroke. Someone in the United States has a stroke every 40 seconds, and every 4 minutes, someone dies of stroke. Every year, about 55,000 more women than men have a stroke. Stroke affects 3 times as many women as breast cancer, and yet receives much less public attention. Stroke is the second most common cause of death in the world, surpassed as a killer only by heart disease. Strokes are an even more important cause of prolonged disability. A stroke often renders individuals unable to return to work or to assume their former effectiveness as spouses, parents, friends, and citizens. The economic, social, and psychological costs of stroke are enormous. The estimated cost of stroke in the United States in 2010 was $73.7 billion. Many people think that strokes only happen to old folks, but they occur at all ages, including infancy, childhood, adolescence, and early adulthood. One of the patients mentioned so far, Claire, was only 29 when she had her stroke. During the last 40 years, I have taken care of over 200 patients who have had strokes before their 40th birthday. Although it is true that strokes are much more common in people over 65, they also often occur in younger individuals. There are now several medical books devoted entirely to discussions of strokes in children and young people. Stroke can happen to anyone. Stroke can happen to you. Strokes in history. The history of the world has undoubtedly been greatly affected and altered by stroke. Many important leaders in science, art, medicine, and politics have had their productivity cut prematurely short by stroke. Louis Pasteur, the great French scientist whose discoveries led to vaccinations to prevent smallpox, had a stroke at age 46 that caused left-sided paralysis, although he continued to make important advances until additional strokes impaired his function at age 65. Marcello Malpighi, one of the first individuals to describe the biological characteristics of small blood vessels and capillaries, and to write about the anatomy of the lungs, kidneys, and spleen as seen under a microscope, died of a stroke that had paralyzed his right arm and leg. Two very important political leaders during the early 20th century, Vladimir Lenin and Woodrow Wilson, had intellectual impairments related to stroke while they were at the helms of their countries at critical times in history. At age 52, Lenin had a sudden onset of slurred speech and right-sided paralysis. An observer noted that as he spoke, the words were often slurred, and he paused several times like a man who has lost the thread of his argument. When he died, his brain showed multiple strokes, and his blood vessels were described as being hard as stone. Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States and the architect of the League of Nations during the first quarter of the 20th century, had a series of small strokes that left him with difficulty speaking and swallowing, and with left arm and leg weakness at a time when he was working hard for world peace and cooperation. All of the heads of state who met at Yalta and elsewhere to divide up the spheres of influence after World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, United States, Winston Churchill, Great Britain, and Joseph Stalin, Russia, had severe cerebrovascular disease at the time of their meetings and would have multiple strokes. Figure 1.1, which can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book, is a photograph that shows these three leaders at a conference. Roosevelt subsequently died of a fatal stroke due to brain hemorrhage after years of very severe hypertension. In Roosevelt's time, there was no very effective treatment for high blood pressure. History might have been very different if the brains of these leaders had not been addled by stroke. Public awareness of stroke increased dramatically when President Dwight Eisenhower developed a stroke that caused his speech to slur, and when President Richard Nixon died after a large acute stroke. The plan of this stroke primer. I began this book by emphasizing the importance of stroke in this introductory chapter, both in general and for individuals. The next two chapters form the foundation of information needed to understand the main findings in stroke patients, what the brain looks like and how it works, and the blood vessels that supply the brain. The five chapters following these describe the different kinds of stroke, their causes, stroke and cerebrovascular conditions in the young, symptoms and findings in stroke patients, and risk factors for stroke. The remaining chapters are about the evaluation of stroke patients and methods of treating and preventing strokes. Chapter 2. What does the brain look like and how does it work? From the brain, and from the brain only, arise our pleasures, joys, laughter, and jests, as well as our sorrows, pains, griefs, and tears. Hippocrates. The brain is the organ that malfunctions in stroke patients. Knowledge about the brain and how it looks and acts can help individuals understand stroke symptoms, abnormalities, and handicaps. This chapter introduces listeners to brain anatomy and function. The vocabulary that doctors use to explain things to stroke patients and their families often contains anatomical and functional terms. I hope that this chapter will make it easier for listeners to follow the explanations that doctors and other healthcare professionals offer. The brain is, without question, the most important and yet also the most complicated human organ. The brain controls movements, feelings, moods, thoughts, and perceptions. The brain makes it possible to explore the environment and to interact with others. Seeing, hearing, touching, speaking, and communicating are all brain functions. The brain is what makes our characters, our abilities and failings, our intelligence, our feelings, and our personalities. Our brains make us what we are. The brain is the most intricate and complex computer yet known. I will explore the brain with the listeners first by describing and illustrating what it looks like from the outside, and then by describing the inside of the brain and its various parts. While discussing and illustrating its anatomy, I will describe as simply as possible what is known about the functions of the various parts of the brain. The appearance of the brain. External surface. The cerebral hemispheres. Figure 2-1 is a side view of the brain from the left side. Figure 2-2 shows the outside of the brain from the top. The largest part of the brain shown in these figures is called the cerebrum. The largest portion of the brain overall, it consists of two halves. The two sides of the cerebrum are called the left and right cerebral hemispheres. The hemispheres are separated into divisions called lobes. The different lobes of the cerebral hemispheres are shaded differently on the illustrations to help identify them. These figures show just the surface of the cerebral hemispheres, not the deeper parts inside. They do not show the brainstem, the portion of the brain that connects the cerebrum to the spinal cord, or the cerebellum, literally the little brain, the portion of the brain located in the back of the head that is attached to the brainstem. The latter two structures are further back and below the cerebrum, which covers them much like the cap of a mushroom hovers over the rest of it. A side view of the brain with the brainstem and cerebellum and spinal cord attached is shown in Figure 2-3, which can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book. The surface of the cerebral and cerebellar hemispheres is made up of folded, raised strips of brain tissue called gyri. Between the gyri are valleys or clefts called sulci. A black line is drawn on Figure 2-1 along the central sulcus. The frontal lobe lies in front of the central sulcus, and the parietal lobe, temporal lobe, and occipital lobe lie behind the central sulcus. These names are derived from common terms for the bony parts of the head. Frontal, from the front of the head behind the forehead, the temporal lobes lie behind the temples. The term parietal means outside or away from the center, and occipital comes from the Latin words for back of the head, occi caput. The brainstem. Figure 2-3 is a left-side view that shows the location of the brainstem and cerebellum in relation to the left cerebral hemisphere. Figure 2-4 is a view of the underside of the brain that shows the position of the brainstem and its connection with the spinal cord. Cross-sections of the different parts of the brainstem are illustrated in Figure 2-5. The brainstem is a relatively small but very critical structure located in the back of the head under the cerebrum. It connects the spinal cord below with the cerebrum above as an upward continuation of the spinal cord. The lowest, most caudal, toward the tail, portion of the brainstem is called the medulla oblongata. This connects to the pons, named after the Latin word for bridge because of its appearance. The most rostral, toward the front of the head, portion of the brainstem is called the midbrain, or mesencephalon. Above the midbrain is the thalamus, a region also referred to as the diencephalon. The brainstem has five major functions. 1. It contains nerve cells and nerves that relate to the head and face and their movements and senses. 2. It acts as a pathway for information traveling to and from the cerebral hemispheres. 3. It acts as a relay station for information coming to and from the cerebellum. 4. It contains nerve cells and pathways that maintain consciousness and alertness and relate to sleep and wakefulness. And 5. It houses nerve cells located in the lower brainstem that control automatic body functions such as breathing, heart rate, and blood pressure. Destruction of the brainstem leads to loss of all brain functions, coma, and death. The cerebellum. The cerebellum, whose name literally means little cerebrum or little brain, looks like a small walnut that is attached to the brainstem and is placed far back in the head, below and behind the cerebrum, which dwarfs the cerebellum in size. The cerebellum helps coordinate all body movements, those of the limbs, eyes, and mouth. Internal appearance and composition. Figure 2-6 shows a cut section of the brain. The cerebral cortex is the gray ribbon on the very periphery of the section. Many of the nerve cells that relate to the brain's various motor, sensory, cognitive, and behavioral functions are located in the cerebral cortex. These cortical nerve cells, called neurons, give rise to nerve fibers that communicate with other cerebral cortical regions. Fibers also travel.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?